Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Bottom Up Radio Network this week. This is your host, Rabble Rouser, waiting on our call from our co-host, G20. So in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and try to find this amazing and very important clip that I found today. Well, here, let's just start with a song. Boom. You know this one. You love this one. Just to let you know that we're here. Feel free to sing along. Like our stoner co-host is probably scraping the pipe right now for resin because he smokes resin. So I want to talk a little bit about what happened today with Stephen Molyneux. If anybody's listening out there is familiar with Stephen Molyneux, then you'll know why I was you'll know why I'm speaking in that way. Stephen Molyneux is an anarcho-capitalist, which basically means he's joined the ranks of the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus because he just does not exist. There is no such thing as an anarchist capitalist. It's impossible. We all know this. But he would have you try to believe otherwise. And I'm sure we're going to talk about what happened today later on with him. But the gist of it is this guy's a shithead. And don't ever listen to a word he says. He's a manarchist, if I've ever heard of any manarchist before. But anyway, I'm trying to find a clip here that I thought was so important earlier in the day. And I just can't seem to find it here. Maybe you can help me out, G20. What do you think?
What am I looking for? I just got cut in. My fucking phone was being bullshit.
Dude, I didn't even realize it was 8 o'clock. Like, I was seriously going to go out and smoke a cigarette and look at a few YouTube videos. Stephen Molyneux.
Wait.
This is Stephen Molyneux. I know everything. Wah, wah, wah. Everyone should worship me. Wah, wah, wah. I'm an anarchist. See how much fun that is to say? See? If you just say it, I'm an anarchist. You are an anarchist if you say you're an anarchist. That's all it takes, people.
So, Rabble, I mean, how was your day? Did you have any good conversations?
I did. The best conversation I had today was with my 3-year-old and my 5-year-old about baking bread. That was a really good conversation. I had another conversation with Stephen Molyneux today. that was just fucking ridiculous, man. This is a plague upon our movement, people. I'm going to say that right now. And I know, Travis, you don't feel this way, but anarcho-capitalists, they don't exist, and the fact that they think they exist, it's a plague. It's a sick and disgusting cancer. And somebody has to set these motherfuckers straight, man, honestly. The inherent idea that capitalism somehow coincides with anarchism is so fucking ridiculous. Capitalism requires hierarchy, period. Anarchism fights hierarchy, period. They don't get along. They just don't.
I think you and I talked about this yesterday. I think that what we're dealing with in a lot of cases is, and I don't think market anarchy is alone in this, is that so many movements go into everything still with the top-down system in mind, whether they know it or not. And you know, the whole notion of capitalism as we know it is that it is, I mean, the word describes what it does. It is about accumulating lots of capital, and that is inherently a top-down economic system. And I'm not speaking of of trading amongst one another, bartering, because those are all count as those are all market transactions as well. There's just no hierarchy in those transactions, and whenever you have a system that encourages things like profit, which is a skewing of market transactions, then you know it's just fucking bunch of bullshit, really. I mean, it's just a load of shit to enable people to have things as they are now, just how they want them to be. So I think a lot of these people, quote-unquote market anarchists, envision a world that's pretty much exactly like this one now, with lots of poor people and a few very, very rich people. And I think it gives them this kind of little dreamy little world wherein they can be the super-duper ridiculously fucking rich people too and not pay taxes. And understand, I'm against taxation and everything that it means, but I'm also opposed to the massive accumulation of wealth that capitalism, as we know it, encourages it. And that's why I don't use that word when I talk about the market. But I have a feeling that I myself wouldn't be too popular in most market circles because I think that a real free system encourages about, you know, a population of like 12 million people on the planet who barely really even know each other anyway. So all that shit becomes meaningless anyway. So I think they just want shit. They just want their cake and they eat it too. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, I'm definitely not a fan of the idea of a drastic population loss. I don't think that that's even necessary. I think this planet does produce enough natural wealth for everyone to have everything they need. I think that we're not necessarily overpopulated. I think that that idea of overpopulation is a tool of the scarcity program that every state in the history of mankind has used scarcity to scare. Just because the people that exist on this planet now, and by the way, I want to say that we're speaking about a very small percentage of the people of this planet when I say this. A small percentage of this planet have managed to somehow completely destroy any natural ecology of the planet. Completely destroy, a very small percent. And the rest of the percentage either face two problems. One is you either have to go with that, making you an accomplice to the destruction of the planet, or two, you try to opt out of that, making you an enemy of the state, an enemy of those people, and not just of the small percent who figured out how to do it, but the larger percent who have gone along with it and are compliant with it. So therein lies a battle and a war that will wage itself until one side wins. And if the side wins that is choosing to destroy the planet, whether they're complying with it or actively destroying it, if they win, unfortunately, we all lose. So I think that the side we have to pick is pretty clear. And I just want to play this quick clip to illustrate my point of how separation exists even amongst a highly populated area. And I think this is a pertinent clip here.
Cool. And just one thing while you do that.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. My name is Stephen Morris, and I've never done this one before. 26 years old. I work down at Fourth Realm. It's a comic book store, and I'm single, and I'm just looking for somebody who likes to have fun, and is a fun-loving type gal, brunette. Something, and so are redheads or blondes. That's tall women or short, because height is in the eye of the beholder. If you think about it, because someone who likes me for me is who I'm looking for, because I'm that type of guy who likes me and we could go out and do all kinds of things. I like all kinds of music. What I really want is someone who will call me and will love me, because I'm always married, and I don't know anything, and it's just not right when, because I just don't love it like anybody else. I don't think it's what it's doing. I don't think it's what it's doing. God, God, God.
I fucking love that guy. Man, he just wants love, man. Yeah, that's a guy who needs love.
He shouldn't have to rummage to the dumpster for a Playboy. That's what the state does.
That's
it makes you rummage to the dumpster for Playboys.
That's
people.
That's
people.
Is fucked up.
Okay, I'll go with this. I'll go with Stefan Molyneux. If Stefan Molyneux promises to never make me go to the dumpster for a Playboy, then I'll download all of his shit. Fuck it.
Yeah, because no one should have to ever go through a dumpster for Playboy. For food, maybe, but not a Playboy. That's fucked up. I wanted to respond to, and before I do that, for everybody listening, this week is a big week for one of our comrades, Troy Davis, has been in jail for 20 years on death row. In the meantime, in that 20 years, the case has completely fallen apart, but the state has refused to grant him clemency and release him. So he's still on the verge of being murdered by the state. I just think that it's good for everybody to do what they can to support him. Send him some emails, send him some love, send him some prayers, email some people, go to Amnesty International, give your support for this guy, who's representative of course, a much larger problem, that is the reinvention of the slave class via the prison system. And so I just wanted to put his name out there for everybody to hear, because it's important. Whatever.
Yeah, I think it's when talking about the prison system, I think it's pretty such a hard struggle for me to pick the one or even 30 or 100 prisoners that I can personally identify with as being freedom being resistance fighters, being comrades who've been taken down by the state, be it for actions that they did commit and openly admitted to committing, which I don't feel the prison system has any right to contain them for. Or actions that were never committed, such as actions in the Green Scare. I'm sorry, I was kind of spacing for a second. Such as Eric McDavid, who's serving a 20-year sentence for actions that were never even committed. He was charged on crimes of thought, and the idea that he had the urge to commit this crime was enough to convict him for the crime. And they actually used Derek Jensen against him in court. They used the fact that he read Derek Jensen books as proof that he was a criminal. So anybody who listens to this show is a criminal, and you're all going to jail. But I have a hard time distinguishing them from the millions of other prisoners who I don't need to be in this prison system either. And I always get shit about that because, rapists, murderers, do they need to be in prison? No, they need to be killed. They need to have their balls cut off in public square by their victim. But maybe that's a bit rash. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really even like my balls, so I gave them away years ago to a stem cell research company. So.
Well, you are. Yeah. Well, you do play D&D.
Hey, I paid my rent for a month. Let me tell you. Hey, one thing I wanted to mention was we were talking about population a minute ago, and note that I'm not for I'm not this callous person who's like fuck the population, let them die. I do think, however, that when the culture crash happens that the systems do come down, and if in the event we choose to walk away from them, I think that naturally, I think the planet is quite strong, and the planet can sustain a lot more people than should be here. But I think that when we're dealing with a natural setting in terms of the first 90% of Homo sapiens sapiens existence, there was a much smaller number. So I think that over time, after the culture crash, there'll still be billions of people. But I think that over time, if we walk away from it, and that's the big thing with me now, listeners, is the whole idea of if we tear it down, can we and will we walk away from it? Not unlike Frodo with the ring. I'm going to fucking drop it. I'm going to drop down some Lord of the Rings on you bitches because Frodo did not walk away.
God.
So. Fucking Tolkien, my dog. But seriously.
What is reality, folks?
If and when the time comes where we have the choice to make of can we walk away from it, and we choose to, then we'll be entering into a new era of a revisit of an old era wherein we do have sustainable communities, and sustainable communities are typically smaller. I mean, in a natural setting, whenever a population gets too big, things end up imbalanced, and there ends up being lots of death. And as Derek Jensen has pointed out, later there ends up being resources for even less than there were originally. So I think that if we walk away from it, we're not going to all just die. We just won't have as many babies. And that's not a bad thing. We'll be a sustainable animal community on this planet like everything else. And right now I do see population as being problematic, but more in a philosophic point of view. There's enough people gathered around who all believe the same thing, that civilization as we know it should be protected at whatever cost, which is the popular cultural meme of the entire globe, I would argue. There's so many people who all agree on that fundamental thing, the pacifists, the revolutionaries, so many of them agree that civilization should be protected, that the population is a problem in that regard. But it would naturally shrink if we could walk away from civilization as we know it. So let's just do that then. So, yeah, I'm good.
Yep.
Later. Click.
Okay, well, let's. I got a video. I got a clip here, another clip, and this is a more serious tone clip. Although I do absolutely love the guy flipping out on the video dating service. That's what maybe people don't understand that. That clip is a video. It looks like it's shot in 1986. The dude's wearing acid washed denim jacket, and he's on a video dating service, and that's why it makes that so funny. I wanted to clarify that for people, that that's what was happening. He's actually on a video dating service trying to get a date.
And at first he starts off so reasonable, so soft, so gentle.
And he's so shy, you know. He's
you know, he's like, I just want to meet a girl, you know, I'm lonely. And then he loses his shit. And if you look up the video, dear listeners, he does fall down. He falls backwards off the stage, off of his stool while he's screaming.
Oh my God! What I got here set up for us is another video clip that I found on YouTube. It's one that's, I guess, it's pretty popular. It's getting passed around on Facebook for the last year. It's an old clip, which makes it even more sad. But I think this is a very important thing. This girl that you're going to hear speaking is speaking to the UN, the United Nations conference in Brazil, and she's going to explain how she got there and who she is and. But I just think that what she says is so vitally important, and the fact that she said it over a year ago to these people. I mean, I got teary-eyed watching this video clip, and, you know, I don't really care so much about trying to appease or to petition the powers that be. I just want to take the power away from them. Fuck them. I don't want to write letters. I don't want to sign petitions. Those things are great. If that's the power that you have, is to write a letter, sign a petition, do it. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of seeing it happen. I'm tired of seeing them scoff at it. And it's exactly what happens here. I mean, they may applaud this girl, but they end up scoffing at her in reality. But I want to play this clip. It's from a video called Girl Silenced the World for 5 Minutes. The girl who silenced the world for 5 minutes. You can Google that. But I'm going to play the audio from that clip right now. And it's funny that it's silenced the world for 5 minutes when the clip is actually 6 minutes long. But whatever.
Hello, I'm Severin Suzuki speaking for ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization. We're a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. Vanessa Setti, Morgan Geisler, Michelle Quigg, and me. We've raised all the money to come here ourselves, to come 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election or a few points on the stock market. I am here to speak for all generations to come. I am here to speak on behalf of the starving children around the world whose cries go unheard. I am here to speak for the countless animals dying across this planet because they have nowhere left to go. I am afraid to go out in the sun now because of the holes in our ozone. I am afraid to breathe the air because I don't know what chemicals are in it. I used to go fishing in Vancouver, my home, with my dad, until just a few years ago we found the fish full of cancers. And now we hear of animals and plants going extinct, every day vanishing forever. In my life, I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests, full of birds and butterflies, but now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see. Did you have to worry of these things when you were my age? All this is happening before our eyes, and yet we act as if we have all the time we want and all the solutions. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions. But I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to fix the holes in our ozone layer. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up in a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back the forest that once grew where there is now a desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. Here, you may be delegates of your government, business people, organizers, reporters, or politicians, but really, your mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles, and all of you are someone's child. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all part of a family, 5 billion strong, in fact, 30 million species strong. And borders and governments will never change that. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all in this together and should act as one single world towards one single goal. In my anger, I am not blind, and in my fear, I am not afraid of telling the world how I feel. In my country, we make so much waste. We buy and throw away, buy and throw away, buy and throw away, and yet northern countries will not share with the needy. Even when we have more than enough, we are afraid to share. We are afraid to let go of some of our wealth. In Canada, we live the privileged life with plenty of food, water, and shelter. We have watches, bicycles, computers, and television sets. The list could go on for 2 days. 2 days ago, here in Brazil, we were shocked when we spent time with some children living on the streets. This is what one child told us. I wish I was rich. And if I were, I would give all the street children food, clothes, medicines, shelter, and love and affection. If a child on the streets who has nothing is willing to share, why are we who have everything still so greedy? I can't stop thinking that these are children my own age, that it makes a tremendous difference where you are born, that I could be one of those children living in the favelas of Rio. I could be a child starving in Somalia, or a victim of war in the Middle East, or a beggar in India. I am only a child, yet I know if all the money spent on war was spent on finding environmental answers, ending poverty, and finding treaties, what a wonderful place this earth would be. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us to not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? Do not forget why you are attending these conferences, who you're doing this for. We are your own children. You are deciding what kind of a world we are growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world. And we're doing the best we can. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore. Are we even on your list of priorities? My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. You grown-ups say you love us, but I challenge you, please, make your actions reflect your words. Thank you.
Pretty fucking awesome, man.
Yeah, I mean that was fucking gorgeously gorgeous video, and you know, I think one of the key points of the thing she said, at least that stuck out to me, maybe it's because of what I'm focused on, is she said that you are the ones making the decisions for how we live. That's the inherent problem right there, people, with centralization of power, is that these people who we don't even know are meeting in a country that most of us have never been to, and they're making decisions for how our world is ran. And we don't have the power to choose while they have the guns and they have the abilities to place a Walmart a block away, shutting down all of the businesses and services in my area that could allow me to take part in a market economy that could be sustainable for the area. I don't think it is. I don't think any economy is going to be sustainable in any area. But there's no option of that as long as the state exists. There's no option of that as long as Walmart exists, or the UN meets and does these meetings, the G20, which is coming up this next week in Pittsburgh. Anybody that can make it there should be in Pittsburgh shutting that motherfucker down, because those are the people making those decisions. But we got a caller. Caller, you there?
Awesome.
Hello? Caller. Caller hung up.
That's some bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. Caller, call back in if you're still listening, unless you got some kind of grudge. It could very well have been Stefan Molyneux. What a shithead. Public announcement. Stefan Molyneux, I will fight you anytime, anywhere.
Dude, what if he's like 6'5 and 300 pounds of muscle and you just can't tell on YouTube?
I don't give a shit, man. I stood off to the whole Denver police force and the National Guard and all of them in Denver this year. They kicked my ass, but I don't care. Fuck Stefan Molyneux. And if he was fucking 6'10 with 350 pounds and he talked like this, I would laugh myself into submission.
Totally. You'd laugh so bad at him, he'd be too embarrassed to fight you.
You fucking South Park parody of yourself.
I am going to go and cry. I am quite large.
Yeah. My brain is humongous. Okay, hold on. We got our caller back. Caller.
Hey, caller.
On.
Welcome to the show.
What the fuck's up, guys?
What's up,
down, brother?
Shit, man. I was just, I actually just spoke to Jason Burmes on his radio show and asked him a question that I was really curious to hear from them guys. But the question was, what good is a government if it becomes corrupt? And at what level do you accept government, whether large or small? And it was kind of an anarchy question, and I mentioned it at the end. But my question is to you guys, like, what level of government do you guys accept? Because, you know.
Ooh, can I go first, Rabble?
Yeah. Fuck it.
I appreciate that, man. That's
no problem,
awesome.
Man.
I appreciate
See what that,
that
is? Voluntary cooperation.
That is voluntary cooperation.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, it's a fantastic question, man. And as I understand, I want to repeat the question, is at what level, you're asking, caller, at what level government, great or small, is government acceptable?
Yep.
That's right. I just want to make sure I'm getting my shit straight, because I'm not
a
smoker. So,
he smokes.
Here's my answer. Here's my answer, is that no amount of state of the state is acceptable. That's my answer to the question, because no matter how small it is, whether we just want to limit it to just cops and courts, if we want to allow, no matter what amount of it we allow, it's what we are allowing that is problematic and ultimately reaffirms itself time and time again through history, is that a criminal organization that gets its funds through threat of force from the citizenry is an organization that, if we allow that, we allow something to happen in ourselves, which means that it becomes acceptable to inflict a certain amount of violence on our neighbors. So that becomes the cultural norm. And even if it's not physical violence, it still is the coercion of our neighbors. And it develops a relationship amongst individuals and then communities wherein we're constantly divided. And not to mention there's ends up being just way too many of us. Because with that type of an organization comes plenty of other rules. They never stay that small.
Go ahead. Well, in terms of anarchy society, like what value is there in terms of having yourself divided amongst everybody? Because, you know, if, say, our neighbor, you know, across the ocean comes over with some tanks, my neighborhood's not going to have any tanks to defend themselves with. So, I mean, okay. How do you justify the defense and security part of that?
That's a good question. Can I field that one?
Yeah, please.
Okay. When talking about organization, now, a lot of people inherently think that anarchism is against organization, or that anarchist organization is an oxymoron. This could not be farther from the truth. The highest form of organization takes place through anarchist cooperative, voluntary cooperation. Now, that organization doesn't exert authority upon those who are not involved with the organization. That's the inherent difference between the state and a federation. If people choose to gather together and pool their resources, pool their interests, their needs, and their wants, and come up with a way that sustainably affects them positively and allows them to work together, then that's fine. I see no problem with that whatsoever. If they want to call themselves any sort of governing body of themselves, that is your choice. That is fine. If you want to make a community government, if people choose to live under that government in your localized area, that's absolutely fine. What the problem is when it comes to defense, this is actually quite simple. People can come together from various walks of life and come together for defense of the community and defense of themselves. They do it all the time. The problem with the state is the state takes that out of our hands, takes the ability of us to defend ourselves away from us. Now, with a neighboring country wanting to inflict some sort of a military a takeover of your area, well, that's going to require a lot of things that would not be possible in a stateless society. Number one, it's going to require that these people have the ability to move the tanks to your area. Now, if they still have a state that exists and you don't, this is where we're going to enter into iffy territory. But in an anarchist world, in an anarchist utopian idea, none of these states would exist. People would still have arms. People could still take up against each other. But people, federations, could be formed and come together explicitly for the protection of themselves and the defense of themselves from neighboring tyrannical forces. Immediately upon the elimination of those tyrannical forces, the federation would then become null and void and not have power. That's the thing that Travis was talking about earlier. Can we walk away from it? We can tear it down, but can we walk away? Meaning, can we discard the ideas of authority and power after we've taken down or dismantled the current system? If we can, then we can successfully come together in times of need or in times of defense to battle against outside forces, to battle against tyrannical forces, and then when those forces are down, we can successfully walk away from that battle. Now, I'm not going to give you historical precedents that this occurs, but I will say that 1936 in Spain, the Anarchist Federation of Spain came together, overthrew their local governments, their local authorities, and began to function under voluntary cooperation within the state of Spain. Now, there were many strands of anarchist thought at the time there, so there were many experimentations done. Experimentation is the highest form of creative outlet. People can come together creatively and experiment with different methods to see what works and what doesn't work. That's when we're going to see the greatest amount of progress amongst humankind. But what we saw happen, of course, was... Go ahead.
Sorry. Hello? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No,
I'm here. I was just going to say, but didn't we already do that over the last several thousand years? We've experimented with, you know, anarchy and different types of government, and what's successful is obviously what's here now. And it just seems that anarchy might be a little bit outdated. Like maybe it's maybe it fits for the O's and maybe the BC's, but it just doesn't work in a society where there's millions of people living in.
Well, it could be that it's not outdated. It could be that it's ahead of its time. It could be that people weren't ready to live in such a structure. But that just because what we have today seems to be on the surface successful for those who are on top, there's a vast amount of people, a higher percentage of the population, and the earth and the land base, the species that exist here, that are suffering greatly because of the success of the few. And the success of the few happen to control the media outlets, happen to control the school systems, and all of the input that we have to gauge success is controlled by those who are successful. So what we have is we have a six-man pileup on the football field, and the guy on top is saying, man, this is great, this works out fine, and the guy on the bottom is saying, can you get the fuck off of me now? And of course, if the decision were to come that they were going to get off of each other, the guy on top would be the one saying, well, let's think about this, let's take our time, and let's do this slowly, because we don't want to do anything rash. Well, the guy on the bottom is going to be fighting for his life to get out of there just so he can breathe. And that's exactly what we have in our political arena, is those on top are saying, well, okay, guy on the bottom, we'll go ahead and create the change, but we're going to do it slowly. Let's do some cap and trade. Let's do let's hire taxes for environmental purposes. Let's create a more environmentally sane. Let's take down our carbon monoxide emissions by 2% this year and then 2% next year. We'll do this slowly.
So
meanwhile,
maybe
everything on the bottom. Well, that's applied democracy or direct democracy is a form of anarchist existence. When people come together, make decisions by consensus. And consensus being where you get the agreement, the express agreement of everybody involved in the decision. And that sounds ridiculous if you're saying, well, we have 300 million people in this country. How can we get everybody to agree on something? You can't. That's the point. That's why there would be no national decisions made that affect everybody. The decisions would have to be made locally because they're affected locally.
And something I'd also like to add is that, you know, Homo sapiens sapiens as an animal have arguably been around. The consensus right now is that arguably have been around as they are for about 100,000 years. Let's say 100,000 years, right? For 90% of that, okay, ergo for 90,000 years, the human animal was a sustainable, had groups that even in engaged in things like trade and even did some farming, even did those things, but they were sustainable population. For the smallest part of our existence, for 10% of our existence on here, we've gotten to where we are now, where we have we are not a sustainable system, and we're damaging the planet. So in terms of something working, I don't personally think that I don't think that the state works the best. I think the state is a virus. It's a sickness, and that I don't think maybe that's not the best criteria, that it's just the shit that has spread real, real fast. But clearly, for 90% of the human animal's existence, we lived a sustainable way, and now we're living in a way that's not. And so I would say that the one that's not more sustainable, in fact, is the one that's been around the least amount of time and is clearly not as effective as the other ones. And then I just want to say this, and I'll shut the fuck up and let you guys talk some more. When we look back pre-history, when we go back further into history, we do see instances of large-scale civilization. We have evidence of that. We have Aztecs. We have the fucking Mayans. We have all that shit. I think they're the same. I don't give a fuck. But we have Native American ones too, right? We were just talking about that rabble earlier. You know, they were a big group, tribes, and they were all fucking collected along the river, and they did shit. But one of the things we also have evidence for is that all of these civilizations this far back in history, at some point they cease to exist, and they can't figure out why. There's no signs of war. They just stopped existing. Because what happened is the people at that time were close enough to a sustainable human existence that they could remember how it was. And when civilization proved time and time again to not work, they fucking walked away from it. They went to the system that works best, the most consistently, and is livable. And at this point, we're so far removed from that, those little pockets have encompassed the globe. And so right now we think this is the only way that we can live. And so I think that fundamentally we have to have a change in vision, which, as Rattle said, is far more advanced than where we're at now, because where we're at now is not sustainable.
Right. Amen. I do want to welcome in another caller. We have a caller calling in for another call. Caller, are you there?
You talking to me, man?
Hey, it's Cannon. I think we're getting ready for Cannon Fodder. Hold on one second on that, Cannon. I want to ask the other caller. Are you satisfied with those answers? I mean, of course, obviously, these are not going to be scientific answers, because all of us are individuals. All of us have different ideas for what we want and need. I think the inherent question that I would like to pose isn't, would it work without a state? It's got to be, is it working with the state? And the answer inevitably is no. It's not working with the state. So the only conceivable logical conclusion to that would be to get rid of what doesn't work, get rid of what's destroying the land base, to get rid of what's destroying our relationships to ourselves and each other, and then go from there. Start from scratch. And I know that's a Friedman-esque kind of clean slate ideology, but I can really see nothing else that makes sense to me. I won't, as Travis usually says, I won't
Who?
Accept,
Who?
As G20 usually says,
yeah,
I won't accept I won't accept a rapist, a baby killer, and a murderer to be in my neighborhood just because he builds a good road.
Well, it makes a lot of sense to me, and I definitely appreciate you commenting on my questions there. But what doesn't make sense to me is just the fact that we've spent all of humanity's history trying to build something that works, but now that we, 200 years ago, we built something that was a wall. It was a shield against all the enemy forces that are coming in, the evil. And now it's torn down completely, and we all accept it. But what bothers me about this is, where at in the whole field of anarchy, where at does it actually take place? Because it seems like to me this might be kind of one of those utopian societies that just never, ever, ever will be. It's just an idea. But it's a great idea. But how does the
Rebel
common guy like me help this you know,
well,
cause.
I answer that question because I approach these things, man. Like, and by the way, you sound like a smart motherfucker. I'm a little intimidated by you right now, but I'm just saying. I mean, you sound like a smart motherfucker. Anyway.
He smokes resin.
I personally feel that it has to kind of begin with ideas. You know, like, and Justin, talking with you in this first few seconds, I mean, you're really considering what we're saying, and we'd probably disagree about other things, but you're really thinking about it, and you're really taking it in and digesting. And I think that what has to happen in terms of, like, macro-level abandonment of this system that we have is a change in vision. And that does start kind of in your head and, you know, if you want to get spiritual about it, in your spirit. But I think right now it kind of is about having these kind of conversations. This plays a really big part, and then we can, you know, and then we start to begin about the practical stuff. But
I got to disagree with that, and I think that I want to allow Cannon to speak for a second, because I think he would be great to have talking about this. That it does. My theory, and I'm not going to speak for Cannon, but my theory is that it doesn't have to just be ideas and conversations right now. We have to start enacting these things, these smashings of hierarchies right now. But I don't want to speak for Cannon. I want to let Cannon. Do you mind if Cannon jumps in?
Yeah, let's do it. Bring him into the party.
Do it, Cannon. What you got, brother? Bring it in the ringer.
I don't know, it's a ringer. Here's my observation about it when I talk to people about this kind of issue. One thing that people keep on overlooking is, God, we live in an anarchist society in a lot of ways already. I mean, here we've had this
very, very
conversation.
True.
Nobody's saying, hey, what's your social economic status? Okay, you get to talk first. Or how old are you? Oh, you're an older gentleman. Okay, you get to talk first. We've all kind of come together, inherently agreed. I mean, we're in a bank line, you know, an older person might come up and be a little frail. We'll help them cross the street or help them, let them go. There's 1,001 ways. I mean, the best things in life to me is friendships and camaraderies and those kind of things. And God, when I go bowling with the buds, we're not like, okay, hey, Joe, yeah, you're the vice president of this bank, so obviously you should go first because you got a higher social economic. Oh, but Pete, you're a lawyer. You got a PhD in law, so maybe you should go first. So, you know, a whole shitload of stuff that we do right now in our lives is anarchistic. And it's just taking those kind of principles and taking them to the next level, I think, is one thing. And then a little bit more macro idea about history, about how stuff has evolved is, I always find it interesting that people think we've hit the pinnacle of evolution right now, that this is it, that capitalism or democracy is the only possible evolutionary thing we can do. We've hit it. That's it. We've hit the wall. Nothing possible can get past this because this is the best system thus far. And that's really arrogant to think. Now, do I have all the answers of what my utopian universe I hope looks like? Of course not. Nor did they at the turn of the century or 300 years ago when, you know, Smith started talking about capitalism, they didn't know exactly what it's going to look like either. I can set some principles down what I hope it looks like and try to strive towards it. But the idea that we've evolved to the highest level already economically or politically is just craziness. It's just total stupidity and ignorance, and that will kill us.
Right. I'd like to piggyback on that, and I'd like to say when addressing problems that seem to be larger than our scope of understanding, there is nobody who understands what you need more than you do. And the simple idea that we can allow a certain governing body of qualified individuals to make the decisions based on the needs of our own selves, especially concerning the people who are making these decisions without any knowledge, concern, or care for the environment, any knowledge, concern, or care for the poor, any knowledge, concern, or care for myself, and I'm allowing them to make these decisions, is absolutely asinine. And the greatest achievements that I make every day are when I'm encountering certain problems or obstacles and I'm able to come together with my family and my friends and loved ones and figure those things out on our own without having to address some sort of higher learning or address some hierarchical stance or call the state to come in and fix the problem. For instance, somebody was stealing from our garage last year, and they were the neighbors that lived across the street, a bunch of young punk kids, nothing to do. They sit around, they get drunk, they beat each other up. They did it every night. They started stealing from us and throwing their beer cans into our garden. Well, I approached them, and I approached them in a kind manner. I said, you guys need to stop doing this, please. This is really starting to piss us off, and it's not a cool way to live. We welcome anybody over into our yard anytime they want to come, especially when we're having events. Come on over, enjoy yourself, get to know each other. But what you're doing is just completely piggish, and I'm not going to stand for it. And the guy said, what are you going to do, call the cops? And I looked at him square in the face. I looked at him square in the face and I said, I want to make this perfectly clear, and you can decipher this in any Quentin Tarantino way that your brain works, but I don't call the cops. And what I meant by that, of course, was that, no, I want to resolve this the best way possible, which would, of course, be peaceably, and we could become friends. But what I also meant by that was, I'm not going to stand by and allow you to do this and sit back and cower, and I'm not going to call in some hired gun to take care of it. I can take care of you myself. And if I can't do it myself, me and my neighbor and my other neighbor and all the neighbors around us can come together and take care of that problem ourselves. David Graeber tells a great story about an anarchistic society in the, I think it was, he's talking about a Bulgarian society, or maybe he was talking about Spain. I'm not exactly sure. But this was a society that existed under anarchism for a short time, and they had a town bully who was just beating people up, taking their food, taking their services, whatever, just doing what a bully does, basically doing what a cop does. Going around threatening violence and taking what they want. And the townspeople came together, and the social law of the town was that if you were going to – they decided they approached the guy and told him to stop. He didn't stop. They decided they were going to have to form a mob and get rid of this guy because he was too big for one guy to take down. So five of them could get together and take this guy out. And social norms of their times was to approach the parents of the person that you were going to lynch before you lynched them. And so they approached the parents. Finally, the parents say, you know, we wash our hands of him. We can't control him either. We can't get him to stop. Do what you have to do. Eventually, they got the guy thrown in jail, they got him thrown out of the town. He went to the next town, and he was thrown into the insane asylum in the next town. Eventually, the guy came back to the community, apologized, made reparations, and existed peacefully within the community. But I just thought the interesting part was that they still obeyed social norms of asking the parents first before they lynched this guy. So there was a level of respect and kindness there, even if they were going to take torches and do a torch lynching. You know, they still followed a sort of protocol of what would be the best way to handle this most peaceably.
And I'd like to piggyback on that.
Oh no,
all right, motherfuckers! I'm gonna piggyback on that. I'm gonna piggyback the shit.
Here
out
we
of
go.
That. I just, you know, I think that Cannon, you really, you know, reminded me of something I absolutely agree with. Is you know, looking at all those areas of our lives that are anarchy and that it actually exists around us, really in mass. And I think that goes back again to our brains and how and our vision and how we see things and in looking at things. In a different way. And, of course, direct action is intertwined with all of this, of course, and that can vary. Maybe you'll stop voting. Maybe you'll write letters. Like we've talked about, there's a lot of different ways you might feel best to go about doing the things that you can do. And also cozying up to the fact that, you know, if supposing that we as a species manage to survive, you might not see it in your lifetime. In fact, you probably won't. I don't think we will. But I like to think of myself as being at the beginning of something that is going to be all the other resistances. That's going to be that's going to be the one that wins. I'd like to think of myself as being at the very, very beginning of that. And it's kind of an exciting place to be, to know that we really helped fire it up in a big, big way. That it might also just be my egoism because I do have kind of a genius
complex. It absolutely
complex,
is.
So.
This fight's been going on for hundreds of years, but
yeah, but ours is way, way, way fucking better and cooler and better looking. So. Fuck them.
Well, hey, caller, thanks for asking the questions. I do wanna say, and I hate to do this, but we do have to move on. The cannon fodder, because we only have 10 minutes before we have our guest tonight. We haven't even announced our guest tonight, by the way. It's Joel Salatin. He's an outlaw farmer. And he's the author of most recent book is called Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal, War Stories from the Local Food Front. Man's fucking amazing. He's a lover of the earth. He's a farmer. He refuses to ship his beef. you know, all the great things about this guy we're going to hear about tonight, I'm sure. I'm reading his book. Started reading it last night, Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal. I'm already 100 pages into it. It's wonderful. We're going to have him in a bit. But, Cannon, are you ready for Cannon Fodder?
Yeah, absolutely. I just got a few bits today this week. So if you're ready, I'll shoot it off. You ready?
Yes.
Okay, just to kind of let everybody know what's going on, especially some new listeners out there. Every week I put together a 20, 25-minute segment called This Week in Radical History, and I kind of call up your show and talk a little bit about some of the highlights of it, and then if people are interested in hearing this this piece, they can always tune in the same place that both of us post our shows, which is radioforall.net. It's a nice anarchist project where producers such as ourselves can post for free internet, you know, these MP3 files for people to listen whenever they want to at their leisure. So Again, that's radio, the numeral 4, for all.net. My this week, Radical History for September 21st is already posted, and I'm going to give you a couple highlights right now. Starting on September 21st, I want to mention that the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website, which is a really cool radical, historical radical website, is now 12 years old. It came online 12 years ago on September 21st. And that's where I get a lot of my kind of radical history, a lot about wobblies and anarchists and all that kind of crap from. So it's a great, great place to go to. Again, that's the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. On September 22nd, 1692, 8 more witches were hung. Not only witches, but also non-Puritans and Quakers and other people like that were put to death or banished from the Great New World. So I always like mentioning that because we have this myth in America about how this country is founded on religious freedoms, and of course that's complete nonsense. It's if you were a Puritan and a certain type of Puritan, you were allowed in this country and everybody else was banished or hung. So September 22nd, 1895, the French government, 1985, the French government finally admits that the governmental terrorism, when it was leaked, that the French planted and sunk the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior ship in New Zealand Harbor. So that's nice French government terrorism for you. That was happened in 1985. September 23rd, 1997, anti-authoritarian, anti-anarchor punk album Tub Thumper, released by Chumbawamba, came out, and I just love that album, so I just wanted to mention that's the anniversary of that album coming out on the 23rd. Also on September 24th, 1794, the biggest rebellion the United States had seen until the Great Rebellion came, when Tom the Tinker started the Whiskey Rebellion by attacking collectors' offices, tax collectors' offices for the federal government, and the rebellion had to be put down by George Washington himself, and that happened in 1794. Basically, the issue there was a bunch of local whiskey people were being taxed, but the big giant companies weren't being taxed for their whiskey, and the people.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, no kidding. People got upset about it, and so that's it. It was quite a rebellion. I mean, it was huge. It lasted like a year. It was lots of death, lots of breaking into tax collectors' offices. Really awesome. Also on September 24th, 1969, Chicago 8 conspiracy trial starts, the charging of 8 people that the state wanted to claim started all the police riots during the Democratic National Convention of that year, of the year before. So that was the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial. Of course, we have our own RNC 8 people that are being brought up in trial pretty soon, too, from last year's Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, kind of parallel to what's going on there. A couple more items. September 25th, 1690, the first newspaper was published in America and was not seen again because the colonists ordered Benjamin Harris to stop publishing the paper. They didn't like what he's being published, and they said, you're not going to publish anymore. So once again, showing the United States was not founded on freedom in a lot of ways. 1919, the Russian Revolution, of course, begins as the Bolsheviks start the purge of anarchist elements inside the revolution. Anarchists bomb the Communist Party headquarters because of the increasing repression from the state. At the exact same time, which is kind of interesting, I think, the Palmer Raid started in the United States, targeting anarchists in the land of the free. Both communists and it's kind of funny that both communists and capitalists had the exact same enemy at the exact same time, and that's anarchists. And I think that's because anarchist philosophy has such a potential threat to authoritarian systems, which both capitalism and communism is. Lastly, a couple more items. On 1975, Senate makes public 738 illegal FBI activities against dissident groups known as COINTELPRO. Those are all those FBI things where they were planting false information, false flag things. It's very well documented and proven. I recommend anybody go on YouTube and look up COINTELPRO about all the illegal stuff the FBI did. Of course, nobody went to jail for it, and that happened in 1975. And lastly, this week is also the anniversary of the sentencing of Emma Goldman, 1 year in jail, and then they deported her. She's, of course, a famous anarchist and feminist, great, awesome woman. And her crime for that 1 year in jail and being deported was she gave a speech against the war. So, again, nice land of the free stuff that America is all about. So that's my report for this week, guys.
Thanks, Mike. That was
fucking
awesome.
I have a book suggestion for anybody out there, graphic novel lovers, comic book lovers. There's a great graphic novel style book called A Dangerous Woman, the graphic biography of Emma Goldman that I started reading this week. We got it from the library, so check out your library. You can get that book there. Phenomenal, tells the whole story of Emma Goldman with great illustrations, written by a woman named Sharon Rudall. So it's great to have a female perspective on a female historic figure. Absolutely wonderful book. I loved it. A lot of fun.
And I'm also reading the other graphic novel, and I think Ravel's also reading this to his kids. So it is kid-friendly, sort of. You just have to explain some shit. And it's Derek Jensen's graphic novel, As the World Burns. What is it, 100 things you can do to
50 ways to stay in denial. Cool.
And it's a great book that illustrates a relationship with the environment, both socially, philosophically, and politically. And it also has fucking aliens and shit, so that's pretty rad.
Yeah. One thing I think that I don't know about this, I love it, but I'm not sure. I was at the river with Fair last week, doing the thing we do for the unschoolings down the river with Fair and Whitman, watching snakes and turtles. And we take silent time when we're there, where we're just quietly sitting on by the river, listening to the water, listening to the sounds of the trees cracking and all that, you know, trying to communicate on a different level with the river. And Fair really quietly under her voice just said, "The empire will end in 10 days." And I looked at her and I said, "I'm sorry, what was that, sweetheart?" She said, "Oh, nothing." I was like, "Did you just say the empire will end in 10 days? She says, "Yeah, I was just talking to the water." It's like, maybe I should stop reading Endgame to Fair as a bedtime story. Perhaps I should move on to lighter material.
Because when the river tells her that Armageddon is coming.
I do want to send a big love and thank you to Mike Cannon. He's already off the line. But, Mike, thank you so much, brother, for doing what you do. You've been doing it for over a year now. He's over a year successfully with the staying consistent with This Week in Radical History. Pretty awesome.
Yeah, dude, you're a rad motherfucker.
Yeah, I love that dude. And he happens to look like one of the brothers from the World Wrestling Federation tag team, the Road Warriors.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's fucking sweet, dude.
That's fantastic. What a great guy. God bless him.
Let's introduce our guest. He's not on the line yet, but let's give a short introduction to our guest. Joel Faleton. I picked up on this guy from reading an article in Mother Earth News, which I do read when I get a chance because it's a great magazine about farming and sustainability and escaping civilization, which, by the way, we need to learn to do before we bring it down, or while we bring it down, because it's really important to know how to grow food. And
that's a good point. Yeah. Valid point.
And it gives a lot of great tips, and it also provides a lot of motivation. For instance, wasn't in there, but it motivated me to bring our washing machine from downstairs in the basement to upstairs, and we're going to be running it off of the sink water and using all of the discharge water as gray water to water our garden. Of course, we're not going to be using any chemicals to wash our clothes. We're going to be using Dr. Bronner's, which is perfectly safe to go into the environment of your area. So that's our project this week. And also hanging up clotheslines. So we're drying our clothes now by the solar power, not by energy from fossil fuels. Not that that's going to bring down civilization, so don't get on my shit, Derek Jensen. I'm not saying that's going to bring down. But that's what, you know, this magazine's good. It does that. But Joel Faleton had a feature in this magazine, and I started reading it, and I really loved his wit. And so I looked up his farm and contacted him, and in doing that, I found this great film called Fresh, and we ordered copies of Fresh, a copy of Fresh to play here, and it's a great documentary. If you get a chance to check it out, do it. But this is from Fresh, and this is Joel Faleton. Any minute now, it is Joel Faleton.
No, I swear to God. Really?
Will allow my YouTube to work. This is Joel Taylor.
Dude, it's all about personal responsibility. So, yeah, Mike Cannon was great. Remember when he was on?
Jesus Christ. Okay.
I found it.
My little girl's in town.
Johnny Saturday night to draw my little pig.
There's a reason why a pig has a plow on the end of its nose. It's not to deny him the ability to plow and put him on a slatted floor over slurry and pin him up with 10 other cellmates in a jail cell. Part of our responsibility as stewards of the earth is to respect the design of creation. That suddenly is something that you can die for. That's something that you can devote your life for.
So that's Joel Salatin, featured in the film Fresh. And what a great timing the universe has, because we have on the line right now Farmer Joel Salatin. You there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the show.
Great. Well, Joel, this is Welcome to Burn, Bottom Up Radio Network, and I was just giving a short introduction to how I was introduced to you this week from Mother Earth News, and have since become a Salinite, if one can exist. So welcome to the show, Joel. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
And my co-host is here as well, just so you'll be hearing two voices. G20, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Welcome to the show, Joel. Appreciate having you on.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
So, Joel, today I spent a good part of my day between baking bread with my kids and making Mexican food, reading Everything I Want to Do is Illegal.
Okay.
And it's wonderful. It's enraging.
Wonderful.
It's enraging. It's hilarious. It's captivating. Tell us the title. I mean, it's obviously one of the most catchy titles ever to exist in the history of titles.
Well, hell
are you talking about?
Yeah, well, you know, it happened at a kind of consortium where I was in London with some people that were talking about, you know, impediments to, you know, local marketing of food, farming in general, that sort of thing. And as it came around to me, you know, people were talking about difficulty with finding labor or difficulty with punching through import-export rules, different issues. And when it came around to me, I just, you know, I was like, what can I add to this discussion? I just blurt, you know, as I started thinking about impediments that we had on our farm, I just blurted out, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. And, of course, you know, the group, at first they all laughed like crazy because they thought, you know, he's thinking about, you know, adultery or drugs or whatever. But then when
and
I...
And you were, of course.
No, I wasn't at all. And as I explained, you know, over our time here, I just explained all the different things that we'd like to do. I mean, from milking a cow and selling the milk to a neighbor to making egg noodles from our cracked eggs for people in church, but it's illegal to sell that without a, you know, commercial inspected zoned kitchen. I just realized everything I really want to do is illegal. And so anyway, it you know, after the laughter died down, and you know, they realized and then everybody began nodding and realizing, yeah, that's true. And interestingly, since I've written that book, I've had, I don't know how many people come up to me, all kind of small business people, from plumbers to electricians to, you know, construction people, and everybody said, you know what, even doctors, and said, you know what, that book could be written about every single entrepreneurial small vocation in the U.S.
Yeah,
and they're right.
Wow.
I would say that's probably true from the accounts I'm reading about. I mean, the book mainly outlines how this country and this government's sole interest seems to be in protecting big business, and in doing that, they have to get rid of the small guy. They have to make themselves the monopoly.
Yeah, because so many of the regulatory, just the way the regulations are written in the country, from tax codes to whatever, are small scale prejudicial and are non scalable to the small operation. I mean, you know, a big corporation can hire a bus to transport workers to work and write that off as an expense, but if you try to claim driving to work to your office as an expense, that's not acceptable. And so we just have, you know, just oodles and oodles of these kinds of things. We just, interestingly, since that book was written just in the last year, we went through the workman's comp program because the farm got big enough, we had enough employees, we had to go through workman's comp. And since we're a farm, So, you know, you have to categorize every single worker. And one of our guys is a delivery driver. He delivers, you know, boxes of frozen meat and eggs and stuff around to our customers or restaurants and things. But since we're classified as a farm, we can't have a delivery driver. The only delivery driver that we can have is a live animal hauler, which is an extremely risky category and costs you a couple $1,000 in workman's comp risk. So here we are paying an extra couple $1,000 for a worker that we don't have because the government says, since you're a farm, you can't have that kind of worker. Well, who pays for that extra $2,000 or $3,000? The customer does. And so the customers then say, well, why is local food more expensive than, you know, Walmart? Well, the reason is because local food comes under all of these little anti-small regulations that are non-scalable and can't spread the cost over a million miles or a million objects.
Well, and the other reason I would say, and I'm sure you can elaborate much much more eloquently than I, is the reason local food is more expensive because local food is really food.
well, yeah, that's for sure. I mean,
there's food in your food.
Yeah, it actually is. It's not pseudo food. It's the real deal. And anything worth having is worth enjoying. But that to me, that's way down the line compared to the price prejudice. I mean, it's almost like if there were five automobile companies, and that's a good metaphor because they're hot in the news right now. You know, what if there were five automobile companies and the government decided, you know what? Four of them, we're going to give them $5,000 per automobile that they make. Well, that'd be fine. But then the problem is, then when the fifth one has to charge the real price, everybody starts complaining, why are you so high priced? And the fact is that, you know, there is a lot of, special concessionary things done for the big outfits, and they come back to, you know, in a non-scalable way to the small producers. But yeah,
well,
you're right. You're right. It really
argued.
Is food. Mm-hmm.
I don't see you arguing for compensation for the small guy either. You talk about how you have consistently denied getting money from the government because you kind of just want to be left alone to work it on your own. And
that's
so
right.
And you're talking more about being against our taxpayers giving money to these large corporations that are already profiting in the billions.
Oh,
anyway.
Yeah. No. Listen. No question. If we were able to, just do business on a local level, just, you know, you and me, and you want to come around, look around, smell around, ask around, and you and I want to do business together. Basically, the old British common law of contract. If we wanted to do business and said it's not anybody else's business. Trust me, the local food system would spin circles around the big multinational corporations. We would, I'm not going to say we could put them out of business, but boy, trust me, they would be half the size, half the scale that they are. We can absolutely spin circles around them. The only reason that it's hard to compete is because of all these regulatory impediments.
Joel, have you heard or read about any of the – I recently read about some legislation that I can't remember right now if it was actually passed, but it was on the floor as something to look at. And it was legislation that would grant the state power even to the local private home gardener for them to come and inspect them. And
H.R. 875, and it did pass. Obama signed it.
Ah. What are your feelings on that, Joel?
My understanding is, I don't know, you know, these bills are so long and they're so complicated, it's hard to keep up with them all. I don't think Obama has signed that yet. I think that passed the House, but it's in the Senate as Senate Bill 510, and it's called the 2009 Food Safety Modernization Act. And you're exactly right. It has some pretty amazing provisions. One provision is that before now, every time they wrote these, you know, food regulations, they always confined the regulations to food that was in commerce. The operative, you know, the legal term is in commerce, which obviously indemnifies or exempts, your own home garden and that sort of thing, or even food that you give away. You know, you're giving it to a raffle or a fundraiser or your neighbors or friends or whatever. For interestingly, this new way they have taken out the language of in commerce and said that any place that holds food for human consumption is liable, which of course means your own home garden, your own pantry, your own canner. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable. There are a couple of other provisions that are fascinating in this thing. One is that for the first time it gives the Food and Drug Administration unwarranted access. In other words, no warrant necessary to come onto any farm in America and check to see if any practices are being done that are considered not science-based. Well, you know what science-based is. Science-based is Tyson chicken houses, vaccinations, pharmaceuticals, drugs, irradiation, genetically modified organisms, the whole shooting match of credentialed, you know, expert the cult of technology is basically what science-based means. It doesn't mean, you know, compost grown and free range and the kind of stuff that makes really edible food. So, you know, those are provisions that are absolutely profound in their scope and profound in their introduction to our law.
And not to mention, historically, whenever the state assumes control of the food supply, consistently there's famine to follow right afterwards. And I think that's telling that they've refined the system to such a degree that they use indirect methods over the long term to do exactly that, I think, to control the population. But that's just me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's certainly easy to be a conspiratist in this, and I'm not going to debate conspiracy theories. I'll tell you, I've done a lot of a fair amount of some lobbying and different things on these kinds of things in the past. And what I have found is just incredible sincere hearts and duplicitous minds on the part of the powers that be. And so I don't know if they're smart enough to pull off a conspiracy. I just think they're so duplicitous that they allow themselves to be played like minions on the on the marionette strings of multinational corporations for agendas that are neither reasonable nor righteous. And but the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And so I can assure you that many of the bureaucrats that I've talked to actually look at me and really believe deep down in their hearts as they sit in their, you know, Presbyterian and Lutheran pew on Sunday morning that their food policing is protecting our culture from people like me from dumping, you know, terrible pathogen-laden, you know, destructive food on the population.
Well, I guess I see that as a really brilliant kind of move by the power structure, if we thought of it like a machine, because it's to the point where even we as citizens, thinking we're doing a great good, will bring about the same results that we've seen throughout history, things like famine and sickness and large mass-scale sickness and death and love the poor and all that. And it's fascinating to me to see that it's become so refined that we will do these things with really good intentions. You know, even in a Christian point of view, we're doing this to help our fellow human being, but bringing about the same results. I just think that's kind of telling.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you should have seen me a couple months ago when I spoke to the Liberty University Law School at the Federalist Society, and they say, well, what's the first thing we need to do to really, you know, have an entrepreneurial localized food system? And I said, well, the first thing we need to do is legalize drugs. Legalized drugs? I said, well, yeah. A government that has authority to tell you can't smoke dope is the same government that can tell you can't drink raw milk or eat trans fats or eat compost-grown tomatoes.
Yeah.
And yet you're exactly right. Christians, the religious right, buys into this control thing without realizing the ramifications that the other side takes and runs with it. And,
well, I think a lot of that rests in the hands, and you talk about this and Everything I Want to Do is Illegal, rests in the powers of the media. For instance, you were in the book, you tell a story about you tell many stories in the book, and one of them, I believe, was about the local restaurant that got its kitchen shut down because of salmonella. Am I correct? It's salmonella?
Yeah.
And they
uh-huh.
put the blame on your eggs immediately. Boom. Immediately they saw your eggs and they're like, oh, that's that goddamn outlaw Farmer Joel. That's his egg. I can tell by looking at it. So it must be the case. And it turns out that it wasn't the eggs. But you didn't want to report that to the media because the media headline would read, local chef's kitchen shut down by FDA, and everybody would automatically assume that the FDA is in the right.
Yeah, and as you know, throughout the book, several times, I you know say that one of the big reasons for writing the book is to try to punch through this automatic assumption on the part of our culture, which you know through the public school system and whatever has been conditioned to just assume that the credentialed expert report from whatever the government organization is, that if they've got a PhD behind their name or some, you know, some alphabet soup bunch of licensed credentials, that we just, as a culture, we've been conditioned to assume that that person speaks the truth. And the whole point of this book is these people have an agenda. They often are not reasonable. They do not speak the truth. They have ideas that if you and I sat down and talked with them, we would find completely ridiculous and unreasonable. And these are the people who send out press releases, you know, by the pickup truckload to the media, you know, pontificating on this topic and that topic and the other. And they don't have a clue what's going on.
Well, I would say then, as far as conspiracy theories go, where the powers that be may lack in intelligence, they make up for in their capabilities of being evil.
Well, yeah, and they certainly make up for it in what I call their shared fraternity of ideas, which is that you and I are too stupid to make any decisions on our own.
Right. Don't trust the farmer.
Yeah.
Farmer's
the average. Yeah. Yeah, the average citizen is way too ignorant to be trusted with making decisions about anything, and so it is up to some bureaucrat to come in and reduce the risk of a bad decision from that. Obviously, the argument is always, well, everybody's not as clean as you. Maybe you know if we free this up a little bit, somebody might get some bad milk or bad food. Whatever. But as if when you go down to the supermarket today, what you're getting is good. My goodness, you know, like most of my customers say, they've learned that 99% of what's in the supermarket is not healthy for you. I mean,
it's all
by
got corn in it.
Yeah,
every bit of it has poisonous corn.
Yeah, by whose definition of safety? You know, I think it's amazing. By the government's definition of safety, it's perfectly safe to feed your children Twinkies, Cocoa Puffs, and Mountain Dew. But, boy, you better watch those compost-grown tomatoes and raw milk. Now, that will get them every time. And, you know, ultimately, safety is a matter of personal choice and faith.
You know, Joe, I think that you're highly un-American, and you're trying to poison the people with healthy food.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, if everybody did like I did, we'd have fewer beds in the hospitals. People wouldn't be as sick. And well, that would really destroy the gross domestic product, wouldn't it?
No, but what we really need is government health care. That's what we really need.
Yeah.
We don't need healthy food from a farmer who knows how to work with the land.
Joel, I gotta say, man, I fucking love Doritos Ranch. You know what I mean? Ranch flavored Doritos. I can't help myself, man.
Joel, I have excuse my co-host. He is a stoner. He can't help himself. He is literally incapacitated at times to the point where he cannot help himself from taking part of the poisons of the state.
Where all I can do is eat a Snickers bar. I mean, that's all I can do. I can't think.
Yeah.
I can't love my life and art and music. I need that nutty goodness.
And this goes back to the dope issue. Joel, in your book, you give a lot of a reverence. And this is odd to me because you describe yourself as being a Christian conservative, lunatic, libertarian. What is the exact term?
the exact phrase is Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic.
Okay. And but you give a lot of reverence to the hippies, which is very rare for any conservative to ever do, is to say that the hippies had some great ideas.
Yes.
But you give a lot of reverence to the return to the earth movement that took place that stemmed from the hippie movement. We see Black Bear Ranch came out of this. People returned to the earth. Can you talk about that? What does return to the Earth mean? What I mean, have we left the Earth? Are we on spaceships?
Well,
what's the deal?
Yeah, well, the way I see it is that the culture post World War II in the heyday of its of our industrial economy, which of course was the replacement of the agrarian economy,
military industrial economy, please.
Yeah, okay. That's fair enough. Fair enough. But as we created this you know, huge manufacturing, you know, industrial economy based on manufactured output, rebar, concrete, and the factory, what happened was that finally, as Joel Arthur Barker in his classic book Paradigms, he really popularized the word paradigms. Every paradigm exceeds its point of efficiency, and as that notion of simply manufacturing power and industrial might and rebar and concrete reached its zenith in the culture, we actually, as a culture, you know, Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, was enamored of Boughton sugar. I don't want to use that old maple syrup and that old cane molasses. You know, we want white sugar and Boughton flour. We don't want that old whole wheat stuff. And it finally culminated in the 1950s and early 1960s with the notion that that breastfeeding was barbaric and Neanderthal, and sophisticates didn't do that kind of horrible thing. And what it led to, of course, was in the late 60s and early 70s with the Vietnam War, was and the hippie movement, the back to the land movement, back to the earth movement, was all a pendulum swing, realizing, you know, you can only pour concrete so long and bend rebar so much and be so industrial till eventually you start yearning for soul and for sacredness, for nobility, for meaning in life, and for anchors, for value anchors. And so this was the baby boom generation looking at their parents who had just built, and stiff upper lip duty and manufactured, and saying, wow, I want more out of life. I want to hear birds sing. I want to know that the salamanders still have four legs and the frogs can still, you know, be fertile. And so we had Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. We had the beginning of the beaded, bearded, braless, Woodstock, Nirvana, cosmic worshiping Mother Earth movement. But it was all part of a nation looking for soul, for meaning, for something beyond rebar and concrete. And, you know, who would know that by the late 70s we had, you know, La Leche leagues, we had Lamaze classes, and men, you know, learning how to breathe with their wives, and actually a generation of men who wanted to go into birthing room and see it. You know, that was an amazing thing. But it was all part of a nation that had lost its soul in its ramp up in production and was looking for something more meaningful in life than just stuff.
Right on.
And that's why I appreciate what that movement brought, brought those values back into mainstream, to where it was okay for men to cry. It was okay to talk about nurturing. It was okay to talk about healing things. It's acceptable. And that was a wonderful thing that they brought back to the culture. Now, we can argue, and the pendulum swung back the other way. Well,
I was just going to say.
Well, the fact is, it always does. The pendulum never slits in the middle. It always overcorrects.
Well, and this time, when the pendulum swung, some of those hippies grabbed onto it for dear life and brought in their values to the government. And
yeah,
you talk about this in the book.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened then was that looking for a better world and casting off all of the can-do spirit of the World War II generation, they said, well, we don't need entrepreneurism to fix this. We want the government to fix this. And so instead of patiently waiting for their value systems to permeate the marketplace, permeate the entrepreneurial spirit, instead they, from, you know, because they, most of them, a lot of them were reading, you know, socialist type material as part of this whole backlash against, you know, Mayberry RFD, they were looking for government help. And what's fascinating today, what's fascinating to me is, and of course, you can imagine, we have, on our farm being, a beyond organic farm, of course, we have tremendous amount of these, hippie type, you know, now they don't have the ponytails, they wear business suits, but they're still that very, you know, liberal, if you will, end as our customers. And I was pretty concerned when I wrote this book as to, you know, offend all those. And you know what? It's amazing that now this food choice, this food choice element of local food, organic foods, food choice, the foodie movement, is beginning to join forces with almost the libertarian, conservative libertarian movement, the Ron Paulites, and I'm seeing this circle completely closed with the whole hand with the, you know, the strange bedfellows being created by these incredibly seemingly liberal folks who realize, wow, the government's really in our way of being able to get raw milk and cheese from a farm and butter and that sort of thing, with the very conservative kind of survivalist independence, and it's a pretty amazing alliance, but it's real. It's real.
So we've got the base of people who support now. How, in your experience, one of the things that I read that you said was, you're sure as hell not going to give up your gun. This is an important aspect, and maybe not to you, but to a lot of conversations that exist in any kind of resistance movement. And whether you believe this or know this or agree with this, what you're doing is a part of a strong resistance movement. How do you feel when I say that?
Oh, no question. Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's fascinating is that the one area, the one significant area where these two groups, if you will, get together is around food. They don't get to it around energy. They don't get to it around architecture. They don't get to it even around really zoning and land use planning and all the, you know, the heavy-handed stuff that comes in with zoning. But around food, you know, liberals, they want to eat as well as conservatives. And once they realize that this once they realize that Monsanto isn't their friend, then they're looking for choices, and they're finding that their government, with their policy that they have put in to be big brother to us, is in collusion with Monsanto, and they go nuts. You know, they realize, maybe this isn't the answer. So it's quite exciting. Yes, it is very much a resistance movement.
G20,
I'd like
you to field this. You talk about what he just said about they come together on food. One of your major points of your theory that you continue to talk about is that controlling the food, putting the food under lock and key is the way to control society, and that's the state's major battle. Can you bring that up? I want to hear what you have to say and what Joel has to say in response.
Well, you know, Joel, my central position is that one of the things that separates us from the first 90,000 years of Homo sapiens sapiens being on the planet is hoarding the food and keeping it under lock and key, specifically, not farming and collecting food and keeping the doors open, but keeping it under strictly lock and key. And when people are hungry, they are easy to control. And I don't mean to sound like a conspiracy theorist. I mean, this is just looking at normal social organization. If people are hungry, you can really get them to do what you want them to do in terms of social organizing. So, you know, and this is a major reason why, again, I'm opposed to even the existence of the state, is because they will always exert that type of control, and that's been the consistent practice for, you know, literally thousands of years. So, I mean, how would you answer that question of is how we do things in terms of farming and even the local farmer, is it sustainable in the long term, and can we move away from keeping the food under lock and key into a more in tune with the earth type of modern day tribalism? You know, I wanted to throw in an ism. I never get a chance to. So.
Got to throw in an ism. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
please.
For sure, an independent people need. Need food choice, and the more that a community, any community that can't feed itself becomes very dependent on some community, you know, somewhere else. And so, like in, you know, in 1946, 40% of all the produce consumed in America was grown in backyard gardens. Almost half of it in 1946. In fact, the average food item only moved 50 miles from field to fork in 1946. You know, that's not that far away, but that is the kind of strength and independence and security. When you talk about, you know, security, food security is one of the most basic securities that there is. And so when you have, you know, a community that can feed itself, that is ultimate food security. But what we've got right now is we've got food that travels an average 1,500 miles from field to fork. We've got the average of 1 calorie of food requiring 15 calories of energy, just 4 calories to just transport it from field to fork. So we have an extremely geographically dependent community, neighborhood insecure, coupled with an energy intensive type of agriculture, and finally the whole pathogenicity issue. I mean, the E. coli, Campylobacter, Listeria, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. All, I mean, all these Latin squiggly words that we've all learned to say in the last 20 years are
not all of us,
but you know, they're part of the modern day lexicon. We certainly say them more than we did 40 years ago.
Sure, but well, I guess what I mean by that is that's still, interestingly enough, it's still a completely specialized area where only a small percentage of the population knows what those words are or what they even mean. And the fact that those words are prevalent in our food, prevalent in our consumption, and only maybe 3% of the population who consumes those foods know what those things are is frightening.
Well, yeah, maybe only a few people know what they are, but everybody knows what they mean. I mean, you know, they
right.
mean they know they mean this ain't good, you know. And,
any word that big can't be good.
Yeah, and so what this is the language of nature screaming to us, saying enough. You know, you have pushed the industrial food paradigm. You've crowded these animals into things. You've made monocultures and monospecies of fields that you have to walk through sheep dip, wear a moon suit and a gas mask to walk into. You've created a system that is so opaque and anti-human, nobody wants it in their backyard because it's aesthetically and aromatically reprehensible. The butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker have been ostracized from the village to China and Peru and parts beyond, so all of our food has to sit in the belly of a Chinese merchant marine for a month before we eat it. And this is all that whole industrial food paradigm beginning to reach its point of reach beyond its point of efficiency and break down, just like every single paradigm in history, including perhaps the nation state. And that every model eventually moves beyond its point of efficiency and breaks down. And so, you know, that's where we are with the food system. And but of course the lords sitting in their, you know, ensconced in their castles right now, they don't want to give up market share, they don't want to give up power, they don't give up prestige. And so rather than trying to compete with we entrepreneurial, clean food, ecologically minded, nutrient-dense, pathogen-free producers, what they want to do is criminalize us so that we can't compete with Monsanto, Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, and irradiated, vaccinated, procrastinated, re-adulterated, reconstituted pseudo-food.
I want to lay a hip-hop beat behind you next time you say that.
No, that was awesome.
Joel Salatin, farmer, eco-speaker, hip-hop performer.
There you go. All we need is a drummer and we're up in business.
One of the things that I found in my readings, Michael Pollan, mm-hmm. great voice, he wrote the Omnivore's Dilemma, which really pissed off a lot of vegetarian friends of mine, which is always great. I love it when people get pissed off. But Pollan's phenomenal in a lot of things he says. In one of the interviews today, he was talking to a lady who said,
was talking to him about these basic farming ideas, and she said, but I'm one of those people who really love the pre-bagged, organic, pre-washed spinach that I can just pop open, put some dressing on, and there's lunch. What's wrong with that? And he said, well, here's the interesting thing about your pre-bagged organic spinach. He said, I've been to the spinach farms. They are much better now than they used to be because they're not using all of the chemicals. Not necessarily they're not using chemicals, because we all know that the term organic doesn't necessarily officially mean without chemicals, and I want you to talk about that a little bit. But when he talked about the calories, the transportation calories, he said where they lack in the chemicals, they ship 1,500 miles, and that's a lot of diesel fuel. So you're eating a salad that's covered in invisible diesel fuel.
Right, right. The fact is that when you shop, the longer your chain of custody, the longer the chain of custody between field and fork, not only the less accountable and inherently less transparent that whole thing is, but it simply is a much larger user of refrigeration, diesel fuel for transportation, and all the other items in making that long chain. When you shorten that chain, you shorten transparency, therefore integrity. You also shorten the energy use in that transaction. The fact is that kind of a salad mix is primarily water. So we're hauling water. If you want to ship something, ship something nutrient dense, like cheese or cured hams or something like that that's really nutrient dense. Don't be shipping a bunch of water. That's primarily what produce is.
Well, the interesting thing about that I love the story behind this, and I don't know how true it is because it's sensationalized a bit. But when he talks about the diesel soaked spinach, he asked you to ship him some T-bone steaks to New York from your farm, and you refused.
Right.
And that's why he decided, or this is the story that I hear, and I like the myth, so I'm going to go with it. he was so impressed by this that he decided to feature you in Omnivore's Delight to a great deal, because the integrity behind you not shipping your – you could have easily frozen-packed shipped a few T-bone steaks to this high and mighty writer figure.
Yeah. Absolutely, and in fact, for me, I've got two things on that. One is that, of course, it was very serendipitous, and he actually was a little bit offended when, who's this pipsqueak Virginia farmer that won't send his New York Times writer a T-bone steak?
I'm a writer.
Yes, I can make or break him, But the offense soon turned into piquing his interest. And then he came down and he saw what we were doing and realized, this is not organic. It's not hunter-gatherer. It's not industrial. It's something else. And then the whole pasture-based kind of pastoral part of the thinking of the meal came about. But the other thing that I tell people then in that story, realizing that most people, when he asked them to send them to him, they sent them to him quickly and thought, oh, this will be my ticket to success. Free publicity is always the best publicity. The other part of that is I encourage people, look, you stay with what you believe. Our culture doesn't have people that are willing to go to the mat for their beliefs. It really doesn't. Everything's about expediency, political correctness, diplomacy. We're just going to sit in here, and if we just talk long enough, we're gonna make the devil love us or whatever. And the fact is that people, your neighbors, your community, people still respect somebody that actually has convictions and hangs with them and stays with them. Even maybe if they don't agree, they'll still say, at least he walks the talk and he stays with it. And so I use that as an example now to really encourage people people now, they say, oh, well, you've got this free ride now in farming because you've got all this free publicity and all this stuff. I say, but do you just remember it came as a result of saying, we are not going to ship food. We really believe in local. We really believe in this food security thing. We really believe in home canning and home preserving and home, you know, transparent food systems and knowing your farmer and that sort of thing. And it was because of that that this happened.
Absolutely. I mean, are you familiar with any of the anti-civilization movement going around right now, any of the writings or the discussions or...
Not a lot. I'm still carrying buckets of water to chickens.
Well, that's anti-civilization right there. So you're not even familiar with it. You're beyond familiar. You use the term beyond organic. You're beyond familiar with anti-civ.
living it, brother.
Beyond familiar.
Well, one of the major reasons I wanted to have you on the show is because you are not only a model, but I hate using the term model because a model would signify that everybody has to follow the way that you did it to make it in this way, which is absolutely wrong. Every land region is different. Every land region
absolutely.
Is different.
Absolutely. That's correct.
And so they couldn't follow the Joel Salatin family farm model of farming for their land if they didn't live in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's a principle.
The principle is exactly right. That's exactly why I wanted to have you on. It fits in line with showcasing to people that, number one, you can do it right. No matter how much people want to compromise or feel they should compromise, you don't have to compromise. You can do it right, and if you're not doing it right, you're really just not doing it. You're just giving in. And I think that's so important. I teach my kids that every day, that even if it's hard, you got to do it what's right. And then the moral question of what's right and wrong comes into play. My answer, and I want to hear your answer, but my answer would be, if what I'm doing doesn't destroy the things around me, but builds them and heals them, then that's what's right.
That's exactly right. In fact, we make no apologies for telling people we're actually in the healing ministry. We're in the land healing ministry, the landscape healing ministry, and we see it as very sacred and noble, and something that's just powerful. Spiritually, emotionally, physically. And so the difference between this kind of farming and food system is that it actually heals. Not only does it heal the land and make, you know, earthworms and organic matter and sequester carbon, and, you know, we do this mob stocking, herbivorous solar conversion, lignified carbon sequestration, fertilization, and, you know...
There it is again.
If
you are a rapper.
You are a rap star.
If every farmer in America, everything is so topsy turvy. If every farmer in America did this with this biomimicry, like the wildebeest on the Serengeti and all this, and did what we do with the organic matter and the cows and all this, we would sequester all the carbon that's been emitted since the beginning of the industrial age in fewer than 10 years. You know, there were way more herbivores in North America 1,000 years ago than there are today. So if their methane is making climate change, why didn't it make climate change back then? So what happens is that you just get these squirrely agendas, and you begin demonizing the very things that heal, and you just create chaos out of simplicity. And so our question that we're asking all the time when we do things is, does this heal the land? Does it heal the community? Does it heal the economy? Does it, does it heal people? Does it empty hospitals? Why doesn't our culture, instead of just measuring gross domestic product, why don't we look at measuring divorce rates, juvenile delinquency, and hospital beds as benchmarks for cultural success?
Well, and I also, Joel, something I think that's important about this discussion is my wife is always saying this, and John, I think it was John Robbins wrote Diet for New America. He says this, that we have a little theological here, but we have a fundamental, I think, spiritual level with the food that we eat, and so there's something important that happens, I think, when people are, for instance, eating any food that they have gotten from your farm and they live in that area. I mean, there's so much more that goes into that food, and when we take that into our body, the state that the animal was in, the state that the land was in, affects actually the food chemically. I.e., a cow killed in a factory where it's in terror and it's this nightmarish existence, that translates into the food chemically and can have an effect on us chemically.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. The adrenaline's secreted certainly have an effect. You know, if you have any sense at all that you are what you eat, or like heals like, or any of those basic, you know, now we're moving off into the more, you know, the big picture of East versus West, you know, the Eastern holistic thought of, you know, that naturopaths and chiropractors and massage therapists and iridologists and acupuncturists and all the quack medicine, you know, that all they believe compared to the Greco-Roman Western reductionist, systematized, fragmented, disconnected, individualized, all about me type thinking that, you know, most Western culture believes in. When you start going that direction, you start realizing that it's only natural that an animal, that an abused animal is part of an abused society. One of the things that we say here at the farm is we want to create a habitat that allows the pig to fully express its pigness. We're studying the essence of pig, you know, the essence of cow, the essence of tomato, because, you know, that sounds very, you know, Hindu, Buddhist, you know, Eastern and all that. But Eastern brings us soul, Western brings us, you know, innovation. And so when we marry the two, we actually have a symbiotic spiritual-physical relationship. And the point is that in our culture right now, the USDA or whatever, they view the pig as just an inanimate pile of protoplasmic structure to be manipulated, however cleverly hubris can imagine to manipulate it. And I would suggest that a culture that views with that degree of manipulative arrogance and disrespect its life forms will soon begin viewing its citizens the same way.
Joel, I wanted to...
And other,
I'm sorry,
cultures, yeah, the same, and other cultures the same way. And so it's only as we respect and honor the least of these that it creates an ethical moral framework in which we respect and honor the greatest of these. The only way you can have, you know, G2's expression of G2-ness and Michael's expression of Michael-ness is to respect and honor the other life forms around us that give credence to respect. You know, otherwise, why would you respect what anybody else says?
So, Joel, I wanted to ask you, you know, I know that you sell meat. So, I mean, I've always been curious as to, you know, for someone who, like yourself, who I can tell just seems to really love the animals on your farm in a very real way, when it comes time to put them down, I mean, what's that process like for you?
Well, here's the deal. The whole world is full of eaters and eating,
mm-hmm.
and preys and predators. Everybody and everything is eating everybody and everything. And if you don't believe that, just go out and lie naked in your flower bed for 4 days and see what happens to you in 4 days. you will be consumed, okay? And so the fact is that this whole thing about, you know, an animal, you know, a dog is a cat, is a child, is a bird, is a, you know, whatever – instead of actually representing a new state of nirvana, you know, haven't we gotten beyond this, actually? Instead of representing that, a new state of spiritual awareness, it actually, in evolved, you know, spiritual understanding, it actually shows a brand new devolution in disconnectedness.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, the tragedy of one of our times in our country is we have become so luxuriant that we have been able to so disconnect ourselves in our daily lives from the ecological umbilical that ties us all to this nest.
Yeah.
One of the things in Derek Jensen's book that we're both reading right now that you would probably really enjoy is As the World Burns, 50 Ways to Stay in Denial. He's talking about bringing down civilization. In this book, he talks about, like, recycling, and he has this little girl who's like, if you just recycled this one can, you could watch TV for 3 more hours a day. And ridiculous ideas. And it's basically an attack on Al Gore and his movie, whatever that was called.
Inconvenient Truth.
An Inconvenient Truth.
Yeah, that one. You know, about his attack on how people's consumption is somehow going to change the way the murderers of this planet are acting, number one. But one of the things, it has this hippie character who's all about peaceful meditation, and he talks to this fox, and he's explaining to the fox, you know, fox, you eat meat, and I just think that that's damaging your soul and your spirit, and why don't you just instead eat this lovely carrot who's not a sentient being? And the fox, you get to read the fox's thoughts, and the fox is like, well, you assume that the carrot's not sentient, number one. Number two, I hate you. You're telling me not to perform my natural function just to appease your own guilt.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
One of the things that Hippie does is he's talking about, you know, I don't think we need to resist in these ways. I just think we need to bring peace to the world by meditating and thinking about it. And he's meditating on the stump of a fallen old growth forest. And all around him are stumps. So he's in a graveyard of dead trees that have been butchered by industry. And he's meditating for peace.
Right,
so ridiculous.
Right. Yeah. Or he goes back to his house and flips on the light switch that's being operated by a coal-powered utility.
Right, and he gets on the line and he orders his brand new Birkenstocks and organic trail mix so he can drive his Beamer up to the trail so he can be one with nature.
Yeah. This is the great whatever I call it, intellectual schizophrenia of our day that people. I mean, we've got, you know, people that have that grow their own garden, preserve their own food, and you know, kind of just keep their nose clean and stay close to home, and you know, don't go to the Nutcracker Suite and have their kids in every you know, Little League program going on. That those people are somehow you know, anti-American, and real Americans are the people that get, you know, diesel covered mescaline mixed from California. And
shoot poisons into their kids' arms and send them to a factory farm school.
Sure, that's the real American, and couldn't be further from the truth. And who of course are too good to leave their computers and go out and get their fingernails dirty in the, you know, soil growing things. So, you know, and yet. Amazingly, there are people now. You may not know this. There's a new word out. It's called the yard farm, and urban cities now are just sporting where half a dozen people will get together, combine their lawns. You know, this country has what, 16 million acres of lawn that could all be producing food,
and half of it's in the desert of Arizona being used as a golf course.
Yeah, for golf courses. Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, when somebody starts complaining of, you know, sending their money off to help all the starving, then they go out and ride their horse.
Right.
You know, one horse requires the amount of land that could feed 100 people.
Yeah, so, I was just talking with Bono about that on the 9-hole, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a, yeah. It, you know, it's so easy. It's so easy to sit and tell somebody else what to do. It really is. And,
well, one of the things you talk about that I like, while you say that, I want to jump on that real quick.
Mm-hmm.
You say that it's so easy to complain. Anybody can complain.
Right.
But it's coming up with the alternative or the solution. And I don't actually like using the term solution. I don't know if there is a solution, but I do know, again, as I said earlier, if the choices you make are helping to heal, then that seems a lot better than destroy. But you talk about, you know, people often criticize anarchists, especially anarchists on a radio show, for just complaining all the time about the system but never doing anything to change it. And I don't want to be the one to sit here and go through my laundry list of things I do every day to have a positive effect on this world, let alone raise two kids to become soldiers in this world of resistance,
mm-hmm.
which is huge. It's huge. But I don't want to go through that laundry list every time. What do you say to that? Like, you know, can you talk about that, about not complaining and just doing?
Sure, absolutely. Well, just doing. First of all, you can discover your kitchen. You know, I mean, obviously I'm going to be heavy on food, but I tell people that say, oh, I can't afford that kind of food, whatever. Look. When's the last time you bought a Snickers bar? When's the last time you put a dollar in a vending machine? You know, you can afford this. There's plenty of money in the system. You just need to cut out the fluff. You know, the first thing you can do is, you know, go take your deer rifle, or if you don't have one, take your neighbor's and take your, you know, TV up on a hill and shoot it. Then you'll have time to do the things that you really ought to do. I was down recently doing a lecture at a college. a prestigious women's school, and of course all the students, we don't have time to get in, deal with our food, we don't have time to cook, we don't have money to buy this kind of food, blah, we just live on, Cheetos and Dr. Pepper. And so I took down some eggs, and the professor went out and got some local cheese, some homemade salsa that a friend had made, brought it, well, actually not a friend, it was made from a commercial kitchen here in the town. And so we went down there, and I cooked up omelets for them for supper for 60 seconds per omelet. We ate like kings on all local food for $1.50 a plate that took 120 seconds to make. And I looked at those college students and said, okay, so how many of you have watched a movie this week? Every hand went up. That's 100 minutes. How many of you watched two? And half of them, their hands stayed up. That's 200 minutes. We just cooked a meal good enough for kings, better than anything you could find in the dining services, and we just did it in 120 seconds for $1.50. Don't tell me. See, it's time to quit being victims, and it's time to start, doing something yourself. And of course, that's true on so many levels. I mean, we used to take food from the area food bank. And they called us and said, could you feed the leftovers to your pigs, because it doesn't help us to get donations in for the food bank when people see us throwing food in the dumpster. I said, sure, we can try it, see how it goes. Well, the second week we went down there, they gave us 4,000 pounds of premium grade number one North Carolina yams. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I love sweet potatoes.
I love yams.
I love them too, sweet potatoes.
Me too.
Oh, one, okay, so we ate them and ate them and cooked them and ate them and cooked them and ate them. And
feed them to the pigs.
We finally ended up feeding them all to the pigs because we couldn't eat 4,000 pounds. So the next week we went down, we asked them, we said, so why are you giving away 4,000 pounds if there's all this hunger and all this stuff? And the guy's very, very, just without even batting an eye, looked at me and said, oh, potatoes are pure poor man's food. These people want ho-ho cakes, moon pies, damaged soft drinks, and microwave.
The truth is they don't know how to cook.
They don't want to cook. They want to sit in front of their big screen TV on their dish and let somebody else take care of them. I mean, as soon as you say that, people say, oh, that guy has no love in his heart and he doesn't care about anything. Not true. I give stuff all the time, but you know what? There are tons and tons of people out here that are running around, being victims that aren't willing to, to lift a finger to really help themselves. These guys have yards. They could put in gardens. They could do a lot for themselves. All of us can do a lot for ourselves.
What people just need is they just really need to have the one tool of motivation beyond themselves. I mean, the state has managed to install McDonald's on every corner for a reason. And we do have a generation of people who don't know how to cook. Not that they don't want to, they just don't know how. I experience it all the time. They just don't know how. And that's the big thing that we're working on at our collective is potlucks. And not potlucks where you bring a dish, because we realized real quick after about the fifth time when we were supplying all the food that the reason we were is they didn't know how to cook. So now we do a supply and ingredient. And I try to get people to bring a local ingredient, and we just cook together. And that's our version of church. It's an ingredient potluck. Where if you don't know how to cook, don't worry. Just bring some of those sweet potatoes. Bring some rice out of your mom's cabinet. Whatever. We can make a meal out of anything. And,
yeah, steal some from your neighbor's garden. Something,
Yeah, something. Shoplift it from the Walmart for all I care.
There you go.
As long as you're not paying for it, just shoplift it. Who gives a crap? They stole it anyway. Well, we got 2 minutes left, Joel. I want to ask you to do something that might be you might not want to do. I don't know. But one of the things that I love is your animal talk. Your animal calls that I hear you do on when I watched Fresh, which is a great film. The you're talking to the pigs, and you got about six or seven different languages you speak on the farm there. Can you give us an example of a few of those things? We've got 1 minute, about a minute and a half left on the show, and would love to end it with you talking in animal talk.
Well, the way you talk to pigs is you soothe them down by just talking to them and saying, come on, pig, 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 hey, pig, 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 pig. It's kind of a guttural, guttural, throaty.
Sounds like Tom Waits.
That's right. Okay. Then when you call cows, what you're trying to do is how a bull goes, ah, ah. Yeah. So you're basically mimicking that shriek of the cow. So you say, ah, cow. And that you know carries on through. So yeah, every animal has their own lingo, and of course the chickens are just they're just happy hens. Yeah, they're just a bunch of women out clucking around doing their thing. So the chickens is just hi, good morning, ladies. You know, there's nothing big to do about them because they're just all clean and enjoyable. So yeah, every animal has its lingo, and you just have to learn to talk to the animals, and they'll do whatever you want them to do.
So great.
Well, hey, Joel, thank you so much. It's been great meeting you, and it's been really great talking to you. Thanks so much for giving us some of your time.
Thanks for having me on the program. Y'all,
thanks, Joel. Everybody, check out polyfacefarms.com. That's polyfacefarms.com. And check out a film called Fresh. Is one that Joel is featured prominently in. Joel, you also do a lot of speaking engagements. We have about 30 seconds left. Do you know your schedule for the next few days?
Yes, actually, this week I'll be at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin on September 24th. Then on the 25th I'll be in the La Corte Aurelius Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in Wisconsin. And then October 5th in St. Louis, Missouri at Webster University. October 7th in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. So it goes all over.
Everybody come check out this criminal.
Yeah. You can go ahead and see the whole schedule on our website.
Yeah, he's my favorite criminal around right now. So for all you criminally minded deviants out there who believe in real food and freedom, go check out Joel at his speaking engagement. This has been Bottom Up Radio Network for this week. This is Rabble Rouser signing off.
This is G20. Good night, everybody.
Everybody, take a punch, give a hug, and always, always, always stand up. Thanks, Joel.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.